Welcome back to Talking Golf with Anne Liguori, and it's always great to talk with Stuart Sink. I had a chance to visit with him on two occasions in the last few months. Actually, the first time in April at Reynolds Lake Oconee in Georgia, where he has a place and spends a lot of time. Absolutely a gorgeous golf destination. And then I sat down with Stuart Sink this weekend at the Travelers in Cromwell, Connecticut. He's a two-time winner of the Travelers, winner of six PGA Tour titles, and the winner of the 2009 Open Championship. Here's my conversation with Stuart Sink.
Here at the Travelers Championship, you didn't qualify for the U.S. Open last weekend. You missed it by a shot. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was playing really well in the 36-hole qualifier, and they just kind of went flat and finished bad. And, you know, it cost me getting in, which I really hate because I love playing in the U.S. Open. I've played in a lot of them, and Shinnecock Hills is a dear place. And but I had to watch it on TV, and I saw what I saw, and it was. I still enjoy watching it and keeping up with the way the tournament's going, but it's much better to be there.
Did you play there in 2004, the last time Shinnecock hosted the U.S. Open?
Yeah, I did. That's the only time I've ever played Shinnecock is in the Open in 04.
So what were your thoughts? It was such a controversial weekend with you know, the greens getting away from them on Saturday, and the USGA saying basically we didn't realize there was going to be that much wind in the afternoon.
Yeah, I saw it, and just like everybody else, I kind of came up with my own opinion about it. But it did look like that the USGA lost it a little bit there on four or five holes, and it's unfortunate because you know, we're out there playing for a major, and I know they want to protect the scores and protect par and. But the players are so good these days. They're really, really good. And I think that if you keep scores around par, if you really force everything to be around par, then the only way to do that is resort to some kind of trickery around the golf course. And you end up with what we got, a little bit of trickery. And it kind of diminishes the greatness of the championship and how well the players played when you've got golf balls rolling off greens and all that. So I think we're getting to a point where now good play has to result in good scores. And if someone shoots 16 under like they did at Erin Hills, it's just because of tremendous golf, not because the course is too easy. The way the players are these days, I think there's almost no course that can withstand it.
So what do you tell the USGA if you had a chance to talk to them?
Well, I just think they have to learn their lesson from Saturday and learn their lesson from Saturday in 2004 at Shinnecock. And you know, you can learn a little bit from Erin Hills, too. Erin Hills was set up, you know, very generous, and it rained a lot. I think Shinnecock was set up very generous, too. It didn't rain hardly any, at least measurably. And then you got a lot of wind drying out that old turf. And you've played enough golf around the Hamptons area. You know, when it gets dry and sunny and windy, the grass just bakes, and it doesn't take long. It doesn't take a U.S. Open. So I think we just have to be willing to accept that the players can just destroy almost any course these days, as good as they are, as much information as at their disposal, as talent heavy as everybody is. And protecting par is going to become less relevant these days because, you know, of the skill level involved.
Plus, I think, you know, the galleries love watching these guys make birdies. They really love that.
Well, I think the galleries love good shots being rewarded, and they love bad shots punished because I think everybody can identify with a poor shot ending up in a bad place. It costs a shot or two or more. So let's keep that going. But Shinnecock Hills does a great job of that already without putting the pins on the edges where the ball rolls off and, you know, seeing the ball, you know, just keep on running past the hole in the 18th on Saturday. Shinnecock didn't need that. And I don't think we should keep the greens nice and watered and wet and soft and have no rough. And you know, we already have a couple tournaments like that, and they shoot low, but they're going to shoot low when the weather's nice, no matter what the course is like. And there's just no point in going over the edge and really kind of ruining the integrity of championship like that.
Absolutely. Not to mention the iconic course and historic course of Shinnecock Hills. How about on Sunday? You were watching at home, and what was your initial reaction when you saw, I'm sorry, on Saturday, when you saw Phil Mickelson do what he did on 13?
Well, Phil is, if he's a calculated guy, first of all. So I've been around Phil a long time, and I don't think he does anything without calculating the after effects that are coming first. So I have a feeling he knew exactly what he was doing, and the course, he probably felt like had gotten away with from them a little bit, and I think that was kind of a statement that he was making, that if the course setup is going to dictate that a two-stroke penalty is the best course of action to play a hole, that says a lot about the way the course was that day. And now I'm not in Phil's head, and I haven't spoken to him about it, but I think that he was probably trying to put down a little bit of a statement there. And a lot of people misunderstood what happened, and there's a lot of calls for DQ and all that, but I don't think that was something that's covered in the rules. I think he chose to play the hole the best way he could and included a two-shot penalty.
Yeah, see, I don't agree with that. I think he just basically lost his mind for a second, you know, and because I think at the time he told the scorer, just give me whatever you have to give me. I don't think he knew at that point what really went down. I think he was so frustrated that he just kind of lost it.
I don't think that's Phil Mickelson. Really? I mean, Phil Mickelson is not the kind of guy to lose his mind. He's played in harsher conditions than that before, and he's kept it together. And I just don't see that Phil would have just been under so much intense stress there that he lost his mind. I just don't see it.
Wow, I love that. I love that story. So what about his he apologized a couple of days later. Do you think that was the right move?
Well, I think if my opinion is correct, and it may not be, but if my opinion is correct and he was using that circumstance as a way to make a statement about the course, that part may not have been an appropriate way to sort of issue a statement. But he's, you know, he's Phil, and he's got some unique things swirling around in his head, and we all know that. And he's a smart guy, so I don't think it was something that just happened. I think it was something that he's kind of had under his hat for a while, and at least on that course, the way that it was set up that day, at least for a few holes, I think he might have been thinking about something like that. But we'll never know until there's a tell-all by Phil.
Maybe. That would be a bestseller for sure. And do you think he should have gotten DQ'd?
No, absolutely not. No, because he proceeded under the rules. You know, you hit a moving ball, take a stroke at a moving ball, it's a two-shot penalty. There's nothing in there that says disqualification.
That other rule, though, that says that he could have, if he deflected it or stopped it, and I would think hitting a moving ball is kind of deflecting it, but...
He took a stroke at it. Now, if he deflected it or stopped it, that means he just, got in the way of it and stopped its progress. But he took a stroke at a moving ball, and when you do that, the rule covers it. It's two shots.
I like to hear your interpretation. The thing about it is everybody has their own opinion, and it's just you hear so many different opinions. So last on Phil, and then we'll get to the travelers. Do you feel that it will put a dent or a blemish on his legacy at all?
Absolutely not. I don't at all. I think people are going to love Phil no matter what. He's still incredibly fun to watch and fun to play with. And so in no way will it diminish anything with Phil. I think the truth eventually will become known, and whatever it is, it was fascinating, really, to watch all that unfold. I mean, the way the course is and how much the tournament means to all of us, it's going to produce dramatic moments like that where someone takes a very unexpected, course of action. And that's what happened. And so one day we'll know exactly what Phil was thinking and what led up to that. Maybe we won't, but... hope so, and it'll be fun to listen to it.
How about Brooks Koepka winning, defending his title for the first time since Curtis Strange in 1989, and really staying focused and not getting wrapped up in all the distractions of the course conditions?
Yeah, I think Brooks is just, he has a sort of an extra gear of focus when it comes to the U.S. Open. And we saw that last year, and we saw that this year under completely different styles of play, where last year you had to really go out there and keep the pedal down and make birdies. And this year it was just all about survival. And he did a great job both times, and he played pretty much the same both years. He drove it where he needed to, and he played aggressively, and his short game was really spot on. So that right there wins you majors. And Brooks Koepka, I think, he seems like he's really cut for the U.S. Open type of event every year.
How is that possible that you peak, especially somebody like Brooks who had had that wrist injury he hadn't played in, 3 months, and he comes back? And what about the U.S. Open, why are some players cut out for that kind of ultimate test?
I don't think there's a real answer to that question. I think it's just an intangible thing that something about the course or the championship, what it means, just brings out an extra level of intensity in some players. And like for Tiger Woods, almost every tournament brought that out. But with Brooks, you know, it's I think it's a little bit more than a coincidence that he won the U.S. Open back-to-back. I mean, Brooks Koepka is still fairly new on the scene over here anyway, and is still a pretty young player, and it's worth studying to find out maybe why a guy can have that kind of focus in an event like the U.S. Open, when it requires a certain type of patience and, you know, driving ability, and it's the whole package. And other players are really like Freddie Couples has always been motivated like that at Augusta. And so, but certain places, certain championships really bring out a sort of a new level, like a heightened intensity in a player, and it produces great golf and puts them up near the top of the leaderboard.
That's another topic for a book, right? It's the psychology of winning a major and picking the majors that you really perform well at. How about you? We're here at the Travelers Championship. You're playing well. You've won this event twice, and I think the players come here and feel they can really enjoy scoring on this golf course. There are birdies out there.
Yeah, I think this course is really enjoyable to play. A lot of different styles of play can succeed here. It's not the longest course we play. In fact, it may be the shortest course we play, but it's also the green complexes are really interesting and different, but they all fit together nicely. And it's just a really fun tournament to be at. You know, it feels kind of like a small town when you're out in the area, but when you're at the golf course, it feels like sort of a big event because you've got a lot of crowd out there and the field's great. So Travelers have done a great job putting this tournament on now for a lot of years, and they're committed for a long time.
They really do take a personal approach and try everything they can do to accommodate families with hospitality and all kinds of things. Can you tell me a personal story of how they make you feel special here every year?
Well, having two wins here makes me feel really special. You know, I get a parking space out there in the front and don't have to valet park, which is really great. One example of what they do, they send two representatives out, Nathan Grube and Andy Bissett. Andy works for Travelers. Nathan's the tournament director here. And they send these guys out. They come out and they don't just recruit. They don't, like, hand out a pamphlet that says, please come play in the Travelers. They are establishing relationships, and I feel friendly with those guys. And one example of the personal touch that they do is at the Wells Fargo in Charlotte, which is also one of the great tournaments. There's a row of glass jars that have basically, let's just call it candy. I mean, it's like a dream in the locker room. And when you leave the locker room going out the door, it's pretty much impossible not to stop and just dip your hand in there and get whatever your favorite is. For me, it's chocolate covered almonds, admittedly a weakness. And so, I noticed this year they were at Charlotte, and up here in the locker room this year, there's the same row of glass jars with whatever kind of candies you want to have. And candy's not a big deal, but it's just an example of the personal touch and the fact that they said, I think the players would like something like that. And they did it. They replicated it here. And it makes you feel welcome.
Well, we know from Andy Bissett that he does have a sweet tooth. So he tells me that all the time. Anyway, Stuart, on a serious subject, with Lisa and her breast cancer, she was diagnosed, about a year ago, 2 years ago. How is she doing, and how has the whole family rallied around her?
Well, it's more than just the family rally, and it's a lot of people, and that includes our family out here on the PGA Tour, and just all over. It's been amazing, the outpouring of support. She's really had a great response to her treatment, and she is in remission. So now for about 18 months, she's been the same. And so she's doing well. She's still in treatment, not out of the woods or anything. But she's handling everything day to day as well as you could expect. And I've learned a ton from her. She'll go back on July 9th for her next really big checkup, which will be, you know, about every 18 weeks she gets a checkup, which is that's the most stressful times now. And really, we gear up for that quite a bit. And so July 9th will be the next big day.